Or I understand that's you. You are the special assistant.
Well, I was the second one. I wasn't the first one. I was developed in the spring and summer of 1965, and Admiral Rayburn opted to set up a small staff in the director's office to supervise what the agency was doing with the bridge and the China problem. First, members of that staff were drawn from various components the agency had in the China-related responsibilities. And the first head of it was a man, Peter Silva, who had been station chief in Saigon, and who had been badly wounded in the bombing, embassy bombing in March of that year, 65. And Pierre, I was asked to join the staff shortly after it got off the ground, and I've been working on Indochina assessments in the Office of National Estimates, and I became the deputy chief of staff. And then when De Silva left a year later to go back out to Thailand to assist Graham Martin and some of Ambassador Martin's counterinsurgency programs in that country, why Dick Helms, who became Rayburn's successor as director, asked me to head the staff and be his special assistant for Vietnamese affairs, which I was for the balance of his tenure as director, and then during Jim Schlesinger's tenure as director, and then during part of Colby's tenure as director.
Is that up until 72 then?
No, I was head of the staff until September 73. Or October of 73, I can't remember correctly which.
Okay. Robert Comer comes out to Vietnam several times in late 1966.
Mm-hmm.
OCO has been formed, but it's not worked out.
Mm-hmm.
CORDS is going to be formed, and Robert Comer wants a general staff for pacification, which
mm-hmm.
is going to become ISEX.
Mm-hmm.
I believe John Hart coins the term. When is it decided that that SAVA is going to handle the training and organization of those first 44 men who are drawn from the military to staff out the region and province officers in ISEX?
Well, we didn't organize their training so much as we were the ones who laid out what we thought their training ought to be and ought to include. And it was more or less, I mean, since our responsibility was to the director to be sure that things connected with Indochina that need doing were done, and the things that were unusual or hadn't been done before, we usually took a look at how we thought they ought to be saved to get them right in the first instance. So the notion of recommending how the training be done fell upon us, but I don't believe we did the actual training. In fact, I'm pretty sure we didn't, because we had a very small staff of not more than a dozen or so people, and we certainly didn't have the facilities to set up a large training program.
I understand from one of the guys who was in that class of 44 people that he got a notice in, he was at a military base in the United States, had done a tour in Vietnam in 65 and 66. His base commander got a message that this guy was going to be called to the Pentagon, and that was in April. Is it...
Of 65?
Of 67, or just prior to the formation of ISEX. And that he went to Washington and met with you and Ruth Robertson. Was Ruth Robertson a person who played a role in the actual training program from the office of SAVA?
Well, to the best of my recollection, Robertson was in the agency's office of training at the time, and I think he did play a role in training the people who were then posted out to what became ISIS. And I may well have met with him and with some of the people who are going to be trained. I just simply don't recall. He would have been a natural fellow to have taken an active part in the training, if not actually running. Because I say he was at the time, as I recall, a fairly senior officer in the office of training.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perfectly possible that I don't happen to remember the actual meeting in question, but certainly possible that it took place. But basically what I would have been doing is looking, sort of trying to see that the concept was adhered to, and then turning over its implementation to a guy who was better equipped and had more time to do it than I or any of my colleagues did.
Did Robert Comer come to you at some point and talk to you about the formation of ISEX?
Well, I'm sure he did. I mean, Bob and I dealt with each other quite frequently by memorandum, but usually by phone or past personal crossing when he was in Washington. And then after he was in Vietnam, I used to go out there fairly often and visit, so he would be back in Washington. We saw each other, so I'm sure he did, but I can't remember any particular meeting of this subject.
You couldn't help me with the chronology then from late 66 until March, April of 67 when this thing gets together.
I'm afraid I can't simply because we're going off of memory, and I haven't thought about that subject for a very long time. My memory's just hazy.
Okay, but Robert Comer would have dealt directly with you in the form, in the setting up of the program.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And when, then you when Bob went to Saigon, I can't recall, he went out to be the head of Cords in some point during this period, because he was out there in 67, but when it was, and I believe he remained in that capacity until well into 1968. I think it was 68 that Bill Colby went out to replace him, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Again, I just don't have total recall, and I just don't remember.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the relationship between the Saigon station and your office as Special Assistant for Vietnam Affairs?
Well, it was an interesting relationship, which on the whole was fairly cordial, but I mean, the Saigon station, in terms of command line, reported to the Chief of the Far East Division, which in turn reported, who in turn reported to the Director for Operations, who in turn reported to the Director. I was the head of the staff in the Director's office, which had a supervisory function for the Director, and basically I looked after his Indochina account for him, but I had no command jurisdiction over the Saigon station per se, except that when I went on visits or if I would send the messages, they used to pay moderately respectful attention to me because they were well aware of the fact that I would then sit down and discuss my findings with the division chief, the DDO, and with the agency management committee, so there was no point in getting any more crossways with me than was necessary. But I, and my relation with this succession of station chiefs, John Hart particularly, was very cordial indeed, except that our responsibilities, though overlapping and to some extent complementary, were by no means identical, and therefore I tried not to interfere with his discharge of his, and to a point he tried not to interfere with my discharge of mine, but I was responsible for satisfying myself and thus enabling me to certify the Director that the Saigon station was performing about as it should and making the kind of contribution we wanted it to make to the overall U.S. effort in Indochina. In that sense, I had something of an inspector general function, but I tried not to push that too hard.
When in late 1966, I understand, decision was made to expand the CIA role in pacification. There had been a debate whether the CIA should pull out of it, maintain the same policy, or get more involved. And the decision to get more involved was sort of what led to ISEX.
Well, it didn't exactly lead to it. I mean, it was felt by a number of people, myself included, that bashing away at North Vietnamese divisions was all very well, but that wasn't going to, the North Vietnamese could always pump more divisions in, so that really wasn't not going to get at the heart of the problem. And what you really needed to do was to assist the GVN in consolidating its control over the countryside with the bulk of the people left, and that was a task to which all elements of the U.S. mission that could make a contribution really ought to do so. That the military ought to construct some of their operations, as the Marines did notably up in I Corps, to assist that function, which was kind of a long-range win-the-war function. I mean, you had to bash the North Vietnamese to prevent defeat, but you had to consolidate the government's hold in the countryside if you wanted to win the war. So I think that the expanded CIA role was part and parcel of an expanded embassy role, an expanded AID role, and even expanded military role. And there's nothing that any individual mission component went off and did on its own.
Okay, so it's just the shift to pacification.
Yeah.
Okay. Ralph Johnson wrote a dissertation in 1981 and 82, just before he passed away, mm-hmm. on Phoenix. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I've never read it, and I wanted to.
In it, he mentioned that he was deeply involved in his abstract to the dissertation, that he was deeply involved in Phoenix, but in the text, he didn't explain how. What kind of involvement would the CIA and Ralph Johnson have had in the Phoenix program after 1969, when the program was theoretically turned over to the military and the CIA had withdrawn from it?
Well, Ralph, I don't know exactly what periods Ralph was referring to. As I said, I've never seen his dissertation or its abstract, but I'd really like to read it. Where did he do it, you know?
American University.
Ralph was very heavily involved in training activities in Vietnam, down at the training center in Vinh Tho. And it may well have been in that capacity that he may well have been kept on after the military took the program over. I don't recall this for a fact, but it was certainly logical, because he was very good and he had a lot of experience in sort of personal institutional memory.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember him, recall his being more involved with the training of cadre and personnel than the actual management of operations in the field. So again, I could be mistaken.
That would have been revolutionary development.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Likewise, would Phil Potter and Rod Landrette have had a role in the Phoenix program? Would you have known what their responsibilities were?
Well, Rod had some sort of special assistance function in the station. He could have had Phoenix-related responsibilities. I'm not saying that he didn't. I just don't remember precisely what things Rod was involved in. I know he was responsible, among other things, for various dealings with senior levels of the GBN,
mm-hmm.
but I forget on precisely what substance that was. And I don't really remember Phil Potter was out there. I think he was up in 3-4. But precisely what he was doing, I just simply don't recall. I mean, I knew Phil. In fact, Phil had been branch chief when I first went to Vietnam in 1958. But I don't have a vivid recollection for precisely where he fit in the overall scheme of things.
Which branch?
The FE Branch 4, which was the Indochina branch. See, Phil served in Vietnam. I think he was stationed in Hanoi in the 52-54 period.
Okay. I believe Evan Parker was there at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
This one province guy that I talked with, who had been in the, was one of the original 44, mm-hmm. who went over in as part of ISAC's province officers,
mm-hmm.
said that his mailbox was the Combined Studies Group. Can you tell me what this Combined Studies Group is?
I think it was an administrative name used for people who were operating as a sort of umbrella to cover people who were operating the ISAC program, to the best of my recollection.
Okay, but would it have been an office itself, perhaps in the Cords building, handling reports or something like that?
It may well have been, or offices that were handling the reports may have been combined under that banner. I just simply don't remember, but it was probably the name. The name administratively and organizationally used for people who were assigned to this particular program.
Okay. Would you know anybody who would have been involved in that I could go to for information about the Combined Studies Group?
Well, there's Parker, if he's still alive.
He is. Okay. If there's a Combined Studies Group, what would be, how would it relate to the Phoenix Directorate? Wouldn't that be a sort of duplication of effort?
Again, I don't know I don't remember who was doing what under what name at what time period. It could well have been a component of the Phoenix Directorate, or it could have been the U.S. administrative entity to which people working on Phoenix problems were assigned. I just simply don't recall. I think it was an administrative umbrella term, but at least I'm pretty sure it was, but I forget the years in which it was used, and I forget just exactly how draw out an ambit it had.
Okay. Would you be aware of any kind of CIA role in Phoenix after the ceasefire?
After the ceasefire? You mean after 75?
After 73. 73 is ceasefire, and then and at that point American troops have been withdrawn.
Yeah, and didn't the Phoenix program pretty well phase down or close down by then?
That there's some debate as to whether or not it did. It was actually, supposedly it was handed over totally to the Vietnamese National Police.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Wouldn't it have been monitored by the station?
Well, there were a couple of station officers who had advisory liaison functions with the National Police, and then that, to that extent, they were kept their eyes and ears open as to what the police were doing with the formerly partially largely U.S. account. But there was no active U.S. involvement that I recall in Phoenix after it was turned over.
Okay. Right. No more staffing of DIOX and PIOX and all that kind of stuff, but just kind of a monitoring and awareness of the program.
That's my recollection, because all this was turned over and the district and the provincial operating centers were manned by Vietnamese, but no given for the U.S. personnel. That's
okay.
Recall.
Last question. Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of ISECs and Phoenix, its impact on the war and its success, or not,
well,
on lack of success?
I think it was basically a very good concept. I think it had, you know, it was related to something that had to be done. And I think on the whole, how much of this you can attribute to any single program, no one knows. I think on the whole, the government was, by and large, reasonably successful, a lot more than it was given credit at the time, or since, has been given credit since, particularly by true believers who didn't like it, in winning, if not the affection of the people, their allegiance, if only of a very pragmatic way. I have a friend whom you ought to go out and talk to, by the name of Sam Or Popkin, who now works for the Yankovic Holding Organization and is a professor at some component of the University of California system, I think at Irvine or Santa Clara, I forget which, I don't think Sam's on the Berkeley campus. But Sam, in the late 60s, was a rising star at either Harvard or MIT, I think Harvard. And Sam has great cross to bear in life. He's an intellectually honest Marxist, and that's not a very easy thing for anyone to be. And Sam got himself a grant and went out to Vietnam to study popular attitudes towards the war and the government, whatever. And when he left, he was given a big send-off by all the best people at Harvard. Because we just knew that Sam was going to come back and tell him how all the Vietnamese peasants were thirsting for the revolution and couldn't wait to depose the vicious Saigon government. Well, Sam was a very gutsy guy, and his mode of conducting research was both thorough and courageous. He would go out and live for weeks and months on end in villages down the Delta, where he would be the only non-Vietnamese for dozens of miles around, and there was nobody to protect him or bail him out if he got in trouble. And after spending 12, 18, 24, however many months he spent doing his research, collecting a whole companion of notes and interviews and stuff, he came back, and he was welcomed back initially with open arms. And they said, oh, now tell us all these wonderful things you found out, how everybody, all the peasantry, supports the NLF. And he said, well, a little bit more complicated than that. That's sort of what I thought I was going to find, but I found that that isn't the way it works. I found out peasants tend to be conservative, and the thing that they like least is paying taxes, and the only thing they like less than paying one set of taxes is paying two sets of taxes, and they tend to view the war as a struggle between two sets of large tax collectors. And by and large, if they had their druthers, many if not most of them would rather give their support to the tax collectors from whom they derive some benefit. tended to be immediate, and the NLS benefits tended to be off in the indeterminate future. That by and large, most people we talk to would just as soon pay their taxes to government and wish the NLF would get the hell off their backs, not because they had a great sort of ideological feeling for or against communism, but simply because in their perspective, they like to be able to throw their transistor radio in the back of their pirogue and slap on their little outboard motor and scoot into the district town for sell some of their rice and listen to a little gossip and generally enjoy themselves.
Did enjoy life, right?
That's right. And when South Vietnam finally fell, it did not fall to any sort of popular rising. Mm-hmm. It fell to 18 line divisions of the North Vietnamese Army, a series of battles in which the NLF and the indigenous element, the southern elements of the force structure played no role of any consequence whatsoever. So if that was the end result, more or less produced, I'm not saying that Phoenix necessarily produced it, but that the government programs working towards achieving that kind of end can't have been all bad or entirely misconceived.
Okay.
Now, this is the kind of thing that's not susceptible to sort of quantified analysis, and you can't say that this program was responsible for 72.3% of this shift in the sort of Hamlet statistics or anything like that. But I think the job that Phoenix tried to do was necessary to do, and I think that the overall attitudes that were prevailing by 1975, the overall attitudes that were prevailing in the country survived, with exceptions in certain areas and certain regions, of course, by and large indicated that the government's efforts to sell its message to the bulk of its rural population had on the whole been successful. Or at least haven't been miserable failures.
And I'd also like to get your opinion on one of your fellow workers, a man named Nelson Brickham.
Don't remember, except by name.
Okay. Well, I tried to make it as...
Okay.
I know how busy you are, so I tried to keep it to a precious few.
Frida wasn't all that helpful.